Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi tenders his resignation, paving the way for fresh elections and opening a new chapter of political uncertainty. The Kremlin says Western sanctions imposed on Russia over its war in Ukraine will not make it change course. And Iraq holds a day of national mourning for 9 people killed in the bombardment of a Kurdish village that the government blames on Turkey. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi has stepped down, paving the way for snap elections that could take place later this year.
In light of the vote expressed yesterday evening by the Senate, I'm asking to suspend the session because I'm going to meet the President to inform him of my intentions.
Draghi won the Wednesday vote of confidence in the Senate. However, 3 coalition parties withdrew their support for his government and did not take part. Last week, the Italian Prime Minister tendered his resignation also. Did so after the Five Star Movement refused to back him in a confidence vote on measures tackling the high cost of living. But President Sergio Mattarella rejected the resignation. He told Draghi to go before Parliament to see that if he could keep the broad coalition going. Draghi began his term in February of last year. With his departure, the President can now dissolve Parliament and trigger snap elections. Draghi is expected to act as a caretaker until elections are held. A correspondent in Rome, Max Civilli, joined us earlier with more details on the latest political developments in Italy. He says that there have been mixed reactions to Draghi's resignation.
Everything changed yesterday when the resigning prime minister held a speech in the Senate, which was as uncompromising as it was defiant and dismissive of some of the parties, namely the Five Star Movement and the League. The speech also included plans to introduce a number of policies on the basic income, taxes, and the liberalization of the market, which were seen as threats by the League and Berlusconi's Forza Italia. In fact, later on Wednesday, these two parties did not take part in a confidence vote in the Senate on a resolution backing Draghi. And the vote, as we all know, saw Draghi failing to win enough support to carry on leading the government. What lies ahead for Italy? Definitely Italy will have snap elections that could take place as early as late September. Maybe a caretaker prime minister until the elections, until the next elections, and definitely more political uncertainty. And the prospect also of protracted uncertainty is likely to unsettle financial markets. It's what most political analysts observe in the past hours. Many said that this was rather an individual choice rather than a choice made in the interest of the country. So, as usual, there are conflicting sides, and many analysts have said that the parties should have tried to find a joint solution in the interest of Italy.
Russia is blaming the U.S. for hampering peace talks with Ukraine, saying that there has been no contact with Washington over the negotiations.
The reason is obvious. It is the destructive policy of U.S. President Joe Biden, who has declared his goal as the defeat of Russia in Ukraine. The American administration forbids its team in Kyiv to even think about talks with us, and evidently forces them to fight to the last Ukrainian. What can we discuss with the United States of America under these conditions?
On Wednesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the talks to reach a truce over Ukraine make no sense. Ukraine hit back, saying that Russia is not seeking peace. Negotiations to put an end to the war have come to a halt since early April. That is when the two sides held talks in the Turkish city of Istanbul. The Ukraine war began on February 24. The West, especially the U.S., has supplied Ukraine with arms and has imposed sanctions on Russia, targeting its economy. Moscow, however, says that even the harshest sanctions would never make it change course. The Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has accused Western countries of fomenting the war between Russia and Ukraine.
You, the Westerners, have fomented this war. It's not just my belief. I can prove it on the basis of 100% facts. You have fomented the war and are continuing it. We've seen the causes of this war. The cause is that if Russia had gotten ahead of you, members of NATO, you, the Westerners, would have organized and struck a blow against it.
The Belarusian leader said the West and Kiev must agree to halt the conflict in order to avoid what he called the abyss of a nuclear war. Lukashenko said the ongoing conflict could have been avoided if the West had given Moscow the security guarantees that it wanted. He demanded that Ukrainian authorities hold talks with Russia and to agree that they will never threaten the country. Meanwhile, Moscow warns that it will stop supplying crude oil to global markets if the U.S. imposes a price cap on Russian oil. The United States says the cap would help drive down global energy prices. We have discussed the issue in depth during our news review program. Let's take a listen.
On this segment of the program, Russia has warned that it will stop supplying crude oil to global markets if a price cap is imposed on it. The announcement was made by Russia's Deputy Prime Minister, Alexander Novak. He was reacting to a U.S. plan for imposing a crude price cap to make it harder for Moscow to sell oil and fund its military campaign in Ukraine. Novak said if oil prices are lower than the cost of its production, then Russia will not ensure oil supply to world markets. Russian President Vladimir Putin has told reporters earlier that oil prices would skyrocket if a price cap were imposed. Europe has been experiencing record-breaking inflation rates and rising fuel prices in the wake of sanctions against Russian energy imports. Moscow says EU is about to go through a looming energy crisis due to its own bans against Russia's crude production. The Kremlin says the situation could create catastrophic consequences in the global market. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Jerome Hughes, who's joining us from Brussels. Also, we have Yanis Koutsimidis, the European Affairs Analyst, joining us from Athens. Let's start off with Jerome in Brussels. Jerome, I'd like to get your, first of all, assessment of this warning by Russia and what kind of repercussions this could have at this moment, not just for the global market as a whole, but specifically Europe, which has been suffering from an energy crisis ever since it imposed sanctions on Moscow.
Yeah, well, what we see is a situation, you know, we heard in the sort of mainstream Western media now for weeks and for the last few days and weeks in relation to Nord Stream 1. And it was certainly, at the very best, it was implied that, you know, somehow the problem with Nord Stream 1 was being manipulated or masterminded by Russia, that this was to try and reduce gas capacity to the EU. But the reality is, of course, that if you speak to energy experts, they say that this was scheduled for a long time, even before February the 24th. We knew that this was annual maintenance. So, you know, Nord Stream 1 is now back up and running. But if you listen as well to the European Commission, I mean, they had a press conference yesterday, Wednesday, and for more than an hour, you had Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the Commission, the Executive Vice President, Frans Timmermans, and two other commissioners talking about Russia weaponizing gas, and so to speak. You know, and of course, this is all related to the terrible war in Ukraine. Nobody in their right mind could support the war in Ukraine, although many people, including a lot of lawmakers here in Brussels, suggests that actually it was provoked by Russia, it was provoked by the West, the expansion of NATO, and Russia felt that it had to defend its territorial integrity. And so, you know, there's arguments around that. But really, you know, if the EU is accusing Russia of propaganda around the whole energy thing, well, I'm afraid to have to say it's certainly there's propaganda coming from the EU as well, because at the end of the day, Russia has it has actually kept all of its contracts for gas so far. It is true that if you look back, for example, to this time last year, the amount of gas coming from Russia into the EU has reduced considerably. But, you know, at the same time, the contracts that are in place have been fulfilled. And this is something we asked the Commission yesterday. They confirmed that. They says, look, as far as we can see, the contracts are being honoured, but you'd have to ask individual member states. But you'd have to look at it from the perspective of Russia. You know, when all of the oil coming from Russia into the EU has been banned, and the coal and other minerals, and unprecedented sanctions against banks and individuals and so on. Why would then Russia come along and say, okay, well, look, you've banned everything else, but you need more gas, we'll send you more gas? You know, so you have to look at it from Moscow's perspective as well. The contracts have been honored. There is a pledge that Gazprom will continue to honor its contracts. But, you know, you do have to ask the question from their perspective. Why would they say, OK, we'll send you even more gas?
Mr. Koutsimidis in Athens, give us your breakdown of Russia's warning.
Well, it's been for quite a few weeks now that there is a discussion among G7 members and in the EU about a possible price cap on Russian oil. But experts are almost, majority of experts say that this cannot work because there are ways around that, because there will be disruptions and many reasons about that. So eventually, I don't think there will be a price cap on Russian oil. What I think it's realistic, it's in the coming months, there will be a reduction of imports of Russian oil to the EU, according to the agreement, of the European Council that was taken a few weeks ago, with the exception of Hungary and Czech Republic, I think. But the real issue is the natural gas flows to Europe. We've seen today that Nord Stream 1 is starting again to flow gas. I think there is no realistic incentive for Russia to completely cut off gas supplies to the EU. What I think in the midterm and the long term, there will be a transition of European gas imports from Russia. And this is something that we'll have to see how much it will impact the European economies. There was a report 2 days ago by the International Monetary Fund that said there are several levels of impact that will hit European economies, other countries to a more extent, other countries to a lesser extent.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Jerome Hughes joining us from Brussels, and also thanks to European Affairs Analyst Yanis Koutsimidis joining us from Athens. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
Britain's Supreme Court says that it will hold hearings in October on whether Scotland can go ahead with a second independence referendum without the consent of London governments. The top court says that it will hear arguments from both sides on the 11th and 12th of October. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has said that she wants to hold a referendum in October of next year. But the British government has said that it will not allow it because Scots once rejected independence in a 2014 vote. A referendum held without London's approval would not be legally binding. Sturgeon says that a majority of Scots are now in favor of independence. She says political and economic changes have taken place after the COVID pandemic and that Britain's exit from the EU. Most Scots voted against Brexit in a 2016 referendum. More protests are held in Iraq after 9 people were killed in the shelling of a Kurdish village that the government has blamed on neighboring Turkey. In Baghdad, demonstrators protested outside of the Turkish visa office despite a heavy police presence. Anti-Turkey protests also took place in the central cities of Najaf and Karbala, as well as the southern city of Nasiriya. The Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi has declared a day of national mourning. He has warned that Baghdad reserves the right to retaliate, calling the artillery fire a flagrant violation of Iraq's sovereignty. Baghdad says that it is recalling its charge d'affaires from Ankara and has summoned Turkey's ambassador. It has demanded an official apology from Ankara. Turkey says it is not responsible for the deadly strike in northern Iraq that also left 23 people wounded. Iran's foreign minister has condemned the deadly attack on the Kurdish village in northern Iraq. Hossein Amir Abdullahian spoke with his Iraqi counterpart, Fuad Hossein, on the phone. The top Iranian diplomat extended his condolences to the families of those killed in the attack. He said that Iran supports the stability and the security of Iraq. Iran's top human rights official has denounced what he calls the contradictory behavior and the double standard policies of some European countries toward the Islamic Republic. The secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights made the comment in protest at a Swedish court ruling against Iranian national Hamid Nouri. Kazem Gharibabadi called the verdict unlawful saying that Tehran will not sit idly by and has several options on the table to respond. Vladi Babadi said that Sweden claims to be behaving based on mutual respect, but hosts and supports anti-Iran terror groups. Last week, a Swedish court sentenced Nuri to life in prison over alleged rights abuses against members of the Mujahideen Khalq organization known as the MKO in the 1980s. The MKO is a terror group responsible for thousands of deaths in Iran.
Illegal and politically motivated. That's how these angry protesters describe a Swedish court ruling sentencing Iranian national Hamid Nuri of life in jail over participating in killing imprisoned dissidents. Nuri is a former judiciary staff who has been convicted by the Stockholm District Court on July 14th of taking part in the 1988 execution of members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen Khalq organization, while he served as an assistant to the deputy prosecutor at the Gohardasht prison outside the Iranian city of Karaj. Protesters here warn that the Swedish verdict has sent negative signals to Iranians.
We gathered outside the Swedish embassy today to demand an end to Sweden's circus trial of Hamid Nuri.
Sweden has no jurisdiction to rule on a case that's considered a domestic issue in Iran. Besides, all of the witnesses who testified against Mr. Nuri were members of a terror group and have never seen Nuri in person in Iran.
The accusations were leveled against Nuri by members of the Mujahideen Khalq terror group, or MKO. Protesters here say the MKO itself has committed countless war crimes, from aiding former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s Iran-Iraq War to the serial killings of Iranian statesmen and civilians in the early years after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The MKO was on the U.S. and EU's blacklist of terrorist organizations before both countries delisted the group in 2012 and 2009, respectively.
The MKO have the blood of at least 12,000 Iranians on their hands. They have no position amongst Iranians, and we call them the hypocrites here in Iran. So I want to tell the Swedish prosecutor that a ruling is tantamount to approving the crimes committed by MKO terrorists against Iranians.
Iran says Hamid Nuri has for the past 32 months been kept in abysmal conditions in a solitary confinement in Sweden. Audio file of an alleged Nuri phone conversation from prison shows that he was prevented from visiting an ophthalmologist despite his worsening eye condition. Hamid Nuri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in 2019 and was immediately imprisoned. A life sentence in Sweden generally means a minimum of 20 to 25 years in prison. Nuri can appeal the verdict.
Protesters here called the whole shebang as a political game aimed at smearing the Islamic Republic's justice system. They described the Swedish ruling as rabble-rousing, which whitewashes terrorism and gives a green light to the ill intentions of the MKO against Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
While Biden pledges allegiance to Israeli regime, thousands of Palestinians in the Masafer Yatta region of the occupied West Bank are facing imminent forced expulsions from their homes. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Marjorie Khan, journalist. This article is published under the heading Palestinians Face Forced Expulsions as Biden Pledges Allegiance to Israeli Regime. Here's more. President Joe Biden's much-heralded visit to Al-Quds has confirmed that the United States remains the Zionist regime's enabler-in-chief. Biden promised to continue providing the Zionist regime with $3.8 billion in annual military aid, more than the U.S. gives any other country, to maintain the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory. Pledging to stand with the Jewish Israel, Biden ignored the exclusion of the Palestinian people from Israel, which extends only to Jewish people. Palestinians do not enjoy the same democratic rights as Jews, as Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, an Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem, recently affirmed. The Israeli regime is an apartheid regime. After Biden arrived at Ben-Gurion Airport, the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Yair Lapid called him a great Zionist and one of the best friends Israel has ever known. Biden said, "You do not need to be a Jew to be a Zionist." The Zionist regime is a Jewish theocracy whose Zionist government was created on Palestinian land. In the newly released U.S.-Israel Strategic Partnership Joint Declaration, Biden and Lapid affirmed that they will continue to work together to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israel, to deny its right to self-defense, or to unfairly single it out in any forum, including at the United Nations or the International Criminal Court. That means the Biden administration commits to opposing to constitutionally protect boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, affirming Israeli regime's illegal claim of self-defense against Palestinians under its occupation, stymieing the International Criminal Court's investigation of Israeli regime war crimes, and voting against any criticism of Israeli regime in the UN General Assembly. While Biden pledges allegiance to the Zionist regime, thousands of Palestinians in the Masafer Yatta region of the occupied West Bank are facing imminent forced expulsions from their homes. Although this would violate the Geneva Conventions, Biden has not condemned it in spite of protests by U.S. Jewish organizations and 100 U.S. Congress members. Biden would not meet with the people of Masafer Yatta or any other Palestinian community whose homes are threatened with demolition funded by U.S. tax dollars. Biden's visit comes on the heels of the U.S. government's whitewashing of the Zionist regime's assassination of beloved Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh, who reported for Al Jazeera for 25 years. Although the U.S. concluded she was likely killed by the Israeli regime military, the U.S. said it had no reason to believe the killing was intentional, but rather the result of tragic circumstances. Abu Aghaleh, who was wearing a helmet and vest labeled press, was shot below her ear, the only part of her face that was unprotected. Al Jazeera journalist Shatta Hanasha, who also wore a helmet and vest marked as press, said the soldiers did not stop firing even after Abu Aghaleh collapsed. The army was adamant on shooting to kill. A CNN forensic investigation cited explosive weapons expert Chris Cobb Smith, who concluded that the number of strike marks on the tree where Abu Aghaleh was standing proves this wasn't a random shot. She was targeted. In a letter sent to Biden in advance of his visit, Abu Aghaleh's family charged that the United States has been skulking toward the erasure of any wrongdoing by Israeli forces. 2 weeks before Israeli regime forces assassinated Abu Aghaleh, three leading Palestinian journalist organizations filed a complaint in the International Criminal Court that accused the Zionist regime of systematically targeting Palestinian journalists. But Biden refused to meet with Abu Aghaleh's family while he was in the region. Biden has refused to reverse other Trump actions that pandered to the Zionist regimes as well. He has not withdrawn Trump's illegal recognition of Al-Quds as the capital of the fake regime of Israel, nor has he rescinded Trump's declaration of legitimacy of illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank or reopened the Palestinian mission in Washington. Biden's visit to the occupied Palestinian territories demonstrates a scant difference between his administration and Trump's in their uncritical, unwavering support for the fabricated regime of Israel. Using American people's tax dollars, the U.S. regime continues to enable Israeli regime's illegal and brutal occupation of Palestinian lands.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hidden Files. Well, for us Americans, the U.S. invasion of Iraq was set like an elaborate game. U.S. forces were to bravely buckle up and eliminate the enemies of democracy in Iraq. Propaganda was pouring in from all sides about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and more. And Americans were encouraged to cheer on the forces as we joined them in spirit. Thousands of miles away in nearly everything we did, even in the games we played, games such as the Iraqi Most Wanted card game, which was promoted back then in 2003. Well, these cards were officially named personality identification playing cards and had on them the pictures of the Iraqi regime officials that the U.S. military was aiming to heroically eliminate. And by the way, these figures include some whom had formerly been put in place and supported by the U.S., but that's a story for another day. Of course, as those of us familiar with politics and propaganda could already predict years later, it was discovered that not only was Iraq void of WMDs, but in reality, it was the American forces which were a threat to Iraqis, not the other way around. Then we read about secret American prisons and all kinds of unbelievable torture methods. And so, as a result of these crimes, a person continues to serve time in prison. Strangely enough, that person is not any of those who initiated the offensive on Iraq. Instead, he's the man behind exposing American crimes in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, a whistleblower called Julian Assange. Welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. And now, let's take a look at what this is really all about, and who is Julian Assange?
Julian Assange is a 51-year-old journalist from Australia, a computer expert and publisher who wanted to give access to whistleblowers to share their information. In December 2006, he publishes the first WikiLeaks cable on the site. On April 5, 2010, WikiLeaks releases the collateral damage of Iraq. In July 2010, the Afghanistan papers. In August 2010, Sweden files a sexual misconduct case against Assange. On October 22, 2010, WikiLeaks releases the Iraq war logs, documenting the U.S. invasion and occupation of the country. On June 19, 2012, Assange enters the Ecuadorian embassy in London to avoid arrest. In August 2012, Ecuador grants him citizenship based on political asylum, but the UK will arrest him if he leaves the embassy to travel to Ecuador. In May 2017, Sweden drops the charges. On April 11, 2019, he is forcibly removed from the embassy and sent to the high-security Belmarsh prison in the UK, where he has been since. On May 23, 2019, the U.S. charges Assange with 17 counts of espionage. In total, Assange has 18 charges against him in the U.S. and could face 175 years in prison. Currently, Assange is still fighting extradition to the United States. In total, Assange spent 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy in London and now has spent 3 years in Belmarsh prison.
Only in WikiLeaks' release of Iraq war documents, 391,832 United States Army field reports were exposed. Now, these Iraq war logs were from 2004 to 2009 and published on the Internet on October the 22nd, 2010. Well, the files record 66,081 civilian deaths out of 109,000 recorded deaths. Now, this means over 60% of the deaths, I repeat, 60% of the deaths recorded were civilians. Well, one would think that after the publishing of these documents, some of those responsible for such war crimes would be held accountable, perhaps made to pay a fine to the families of the victims or sentenced to time in prison. Unfortunately, the reality could be nothing further from the truth. And even one of the leaders of that fabricated Western war against Iraq, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, is even said to be knighted by the Queen. So in this world where values seem to be upside down, wouldn't you know it that it is Assange, the whistleblower, who ended up being investigated, tracked down, and incarcerated. Assange is paying the price for exposing the crimes, but the criminals who committed the crimes continue to walk free and in some instances are hailed as heroes. And Assange is facing possible extradition to the United States and a 175 years prison sentence, if that's possible. Well, stay with us as we look a little closer at all of this with our first guest.
Dr. Deepa Govindarajan Driver. She has served 3 years as a legal observer in the case of Julian Assange. She is a trade unionist and is interested in state and corporate accountability, as well as the protection of whistleblowers. Dr. Driver teaches governance, compliance, risk management, and regulation.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Driver. Now, you have been an observer for more than 3 years at the Julian Assange trial. Why have you been in court during that time?
Thanks for asking the question. About 3.5 years ago, I started to monitor this case on behalf of the and through the process on behalf of the Haldane Society of Socialist Lawyers and the ALDH. Because I think this case is really important for ordinary people, people like you and me and people in your audience, who want to know, who want to understand what's happening behind closed doors. As an academic, I study whistleblowing and governance. And whether it's a care home where an elderly relative is being mistreated, or whether it's a prison where somebody's being harmed, or whether it's climate justice and dumping toxic waste, or whether it is war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. The only way we know about what really happens behind closed doors is through the courage of whistleblowers.
Well, what message do you think the U.S. is trying to give to journalists and others with the Assange case?
It was very, very courageous in the way it stood up to the world's greatest superpower, that is America, when they said, you know, you have all this evidence. It is accurate. Nobody was able to challenge its accuracy, whether it was torture at Guantanamo or war crimes in Iraq or the Americans putting pressure on the Germans not to allow Khaled El-Masri's case to come to trial. You know, he was this German citizen who was indicted, sodomized, tortured, and then they found it was a case of mistaken identity. So this kind of information only came into the public domain in a way in which the Americans couldn't deny it, thanks to WikiLeaks. And then you have the situation where the Americans then said to WikiLeaks, hang on a second, you're not allowed to share this because it shows our criminality. And the criminality of our allies. Firstly, Assange is not a US citizen. He didn't carry out any of his journalism in the US either. He's a non-UNIS citizen carrying out serious journalism about US war crimes abroad. And the US is trying to use the Espionage Act, which is an act that was created in 1917, I believe, or thereabouts, and which is highly contested, which is not seen as a very benign act, especially now. And its use against a journalist is deeply troubling because, you know, to classify journalism as espionage is deeply worrying. But what is also worrying is the fact that instead of the people who tortured the 789 Muslim men in Guantanamo being on trial, we now have Julian Assange being silenced in Belmarsh. And that sends a message to journalists. It says, tomorrow, if you were to receive a whistleblower telling you, here's another Guantanamo happening, and you're not a journalist sitting in the US, you're somewhere else in the world, will you disclose those war crimes, knowing that the United States has extradition treaties with various countries? So this is not going to, you know, a lot of people say, oh, this is going to set a chilling precedent for journalism with Julian's extradited. But the chilling precedent has already been set. Nobody, no journalist, is safe now. And we need to stop this right now.
Yeah, indeed. It's so troubling. Dr. Driver, I want to look at Britain's role in all of this because, as you know, the Home Secretary has recently given the okay for Assange to be extradited. Your take on that side of things?
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, here is a peaceful man, an intellectual, one of the intellectual giants of our time, one of the greatest political prisoners of our time, being held in a maximum security prison because Britain is hugely complicit in a lot of this torture and this criminality abroad. The Home Secretary's decision reflects a sentiment that seems to permeate through the British system and the British establishment, which is a certain willful blindness to what is being done to Assange. What's interesting is that now establishment actors like David Davis, the Conservative MP, the senior Conservative MP, a lot of human rights organizations, whether it's Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, press freedom organizations all around the world, including the IFJ, Reporters Sans Frontières, and others, have all come out and condemned this. And the Council of Europe's human rights expert has also condemned this, as has the UN's rapporteur on torture. So the UK is really behaving like a rogue state. And it was very obvious what they had done when they extracted Mr. Assange from the embassy. Because when they did that, Mr. Assange was in asylum. He was an Ecuadorian citizen. Now, no matter what kinds of deals you have, extraditing him, pulling him out of that embassy without giving him due process, without revoking his citizenship, without revoking his asylum through the full court process, is in itself a breach of the basics of, you know, international cooperation. And so the US, the UK, Alan Duncan, the MP, the former MP, has admitted to organizing this extraction from the embassy in collusion with Ecuador and the US. So this is not a standard process. This is not Britain upholding the rule of law. In fact, Britain has shamed itself yet again in terms of the rule of law.
Well, where does everything stand now with the Home Secretary giving the okay for him to be extradited? What's next for Assange's legal team?
Well, there's a number of different things. One is when domestic remedies are exhausted, then you can go to the European Court of Human Rights. And on the factor, which is the assurances, these absolutely hollow assurances that the US gave that maybe they won't torture him if they decide when he gets there that he hasn't done anything that merits torture, in effect. You know, that's the nature of the assurances they have given. It's laughable. So on that count, that presumably will go through the European Court of Human Rights process. There is also an appeal against Priti Patel's decision which has to go through the process. And lastly, and most importantly, Julian Assange won his case against extradition at the magistrate's court. So he won, basically, in relation to the health conditions and the U.S. prison conditions, right? So many of the other conditions that he lost on, whether it was questions in relation to press freedom, democracy, the extraterritorial rights of the U.S., the ability to extradite a journalist, were not actually debated, because then you had the U.S. appeal and all you could talk about were the grounds for U.S. appeal. So now Julian's lawyers will launch something called a cross appeal, which contests all those grounds that he lost at the magistrate's court, and then that will go through to the Court of Appeal and then presumably to the Supreme Court if there are points of law that need to be agreed. So the process will continue. The way whistleblowers and journalists are treated is very evident. The way America has zero respect for international law is evident through the fact that Guantanamo is still open 20 years after it was, you know, set up. And we know from the fact that the United States has been able to charge only a handful of people at Guantanamo, that a lot of innocent people were tortured, abducted, raped, sodomized at the behest of America, all the while America is telling the world, oh, we care about human rights, we care about press freedom, we care about democracy.
It's absolutely unbelievable. We thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Driver, right here at Hidden Files. Well, as you've just heard, Julian Assange has been subjected to so many injustices. He has been deprived of sunlight for practically 10 years now. And while he was at the Ecuadorian embassy for those 7 years, Assange was also spied upon by the CIA, who watched and listened to him through embassy CCTV, even while he was having confidential meetings with his lawyer. And in 2017, when Mike Pompeo was the head of the CIA, his agency planned to kidnap or kill Assange. Now, American officials were embarrassed because WikiLeaks had published Vault 7, a set of CIA hacking tools. And in that same year, Pompeo named WikiLeaks as a non-state hostile intelligence service, basically giving the agency the green light to do whatever it could to contain or eliminate Assange. Well, let's cross over to our next guest right now.
John Kiriakou. He's a former CIA officer. He had a top-secret, sensitive security clearance. Kiriakou turned whistleblower against CIA crimes. In 2012, he became the first CIA officer to be convicted of passing on classified information to a reporter. Kiriakou is also an author and has been a TV consultant.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, John. Pleasure to have you. I want to talk about the price that whistleblowers have to pay for exposing the truth.
That's a good question and an important one. It's hard to be a whistleblower. The price is quite high. You will give up your life as you know it. You'll be unemployable. In many cases, your friends walk away from you. In many cases, your family walks away from you. You'll never have, at least in my case, I'll never have a security clearance again. I'll never be able to get a job in corporate America. I'm radioactive. I've had friends tell me privately that they support me, they're pulling for me, but they're very sorry they can't be seen in public with me. I had one friend and former colleague who sent a middleman to my house to shake my hand when I got home from prison, to say welcome home, and that he hoped I understood that we could never speak to each other again. So this is quite common. And on top of all that, you have to consider the legal expenses. In my case, I ran up legal bills of $1,150,000. Bills that I will never be able to pay. Julian's bills so far have been more like $5 or $6 million. And so, you know, it's one of these things where the goal isn't even necessarily to win in court. and to incarcerate you. It's to ruin you so you can never make a comeback. And then more importantly, it's to frighten anybody else who's thinking of blowing the whistle on waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality so that they keep their mouths shut.
That's absolutely mind-boggling, John. I mean, what do you make of all of this? Your take on actually those who are innocent are the ones who end up paying the price, and those who are guilty seem to get off.
Yeah, you know, on the first day of employment, for every employee of the federal government, you put your right hand up in the air and you swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Well, I took that oath very seriously. And to me, in my case, I blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program. I believed that the torture program was illegal in addition to being immoral and unethical. And I thought, certainly others believe as I do, certainly somebody will say something. And nobody did. And finally, it got so bad that the White House was denying that there was a torture. They were denying that there were secret prisons. They were denying that there was a rendition program. And I just couldn't remain silent any longer. You know, a crime is a crime is a crime. And the American people have the right to know what their government is doing in their name. And so I went public. In Julian's case, it was very similar, where you can dislike the fact that he released millions of pages of documents, none of which harmed the national security, I might add, and that came from the intelligence community. But one of the things that he did release was a video of American servicemen committing war crimes, clearly committing war crimes. So why weren't the perpetrators of the war crimes arrested? Why was Julian Assange arrested? Why are we arresting the messenger?
Unbelievable. Well, thank you so much. Definitely admire your courage. John Chirico, appreciate you being with us right here at Hidden Files. According to Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, in a recent statement, he says that the Statue of Liberty should be torn down if WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is sentenced in the United States. Well, we're keeping our eyes on this case. Until next time, I'm Marzia Hashmi, and this is Hidden Files.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.